There are an amazing number of stories surrounding World War II. And I think what's even more incredible is that there are stories still being uncovered and mysteries being solved 70 years after the war has ended. Hi, Larry Mueller here. Thanks for joining us today on the Ideas Network. We're going to delve into one of those mysteries today. And I can tell you, it's really a fascinating story. Will Hilton is a contributing writer at the New York Times Magazine. His work has been featured on the cover of Harper's, GQ, Esquire, Rolling Stone, many other magazines. And he's the author of the book we're going to discuss today. It's called Vanished, The 60-Year Search for the Missing Men of World War II. And he joins us today from the studio of NPR affiliate WYPR in Baltimore. Will Hilton, thank you for spending time with us today. Let's see. Yeah, Bill, Will, are you there? Will, are you there? Let's see. We are having a little bit of trouble finding him, but maybe we will be able to figure this out. In the meantime, I will invite you. I'm sure we're going to be able to get him on. I hope that you'll stay tuned for this. I'm sure that there are many people listening here who had a serviceman or woman in the family who may have served in action in World War II. Did you have a loved one fight in World War II? What stories did you hear? If you're a member of the military, how important is it for you to know that you will not be forgotten? Those are some of the things that I really would like to talk about today with Will. And it's not his fault, by the way. We're having a little technical difficulty getting him on the air here. So we will do that
now. 2011.
Are you there now?
881.
Okay. Hello.
That should be it.
Hello, Will.
Yep. All right, cool.
Hello, Will.
Resend that message.
Let's see. I think we have him on, but he can't, for some reason, can't hear me. I think is the case. So we're going to keep at it here. Let me try once more here. Will Hilton, are you there? Oh, boy. I am not. I have no idea why we're... Now let's try it again. Will, are you there? No. It's just a mystery to me right at the moment as to why we don't have him on the air here. Because there's so many things I wanted to visit with him about. In the fall of 1994, or I'm sorry, 1944, this American bomber carried 11 men, and it vanished over the Pacific islands of Palau. And it left a trail of mysteries. And there were, you know, there were mission reports from the Army, the Air Force, the Army Air Forces. The plane apparently crashed in shallow water. But when investigators went to find it, the wreckage wasn't there. And witnesses saw the crew, some of the crew at least, parachute to safety.
Oh, okay.
But the airmen were never seen again. And some of their relatives whispered that they had returned to the United States in secret and lived in hiding, but never explained why. And so this mystery has persisted, or did persist, for 60 years. And the U.S. government, the children of the missing men, and there was a kind of a maverick team of scientists and scuba divers who searched the islands for clues. And they trolled the water. They used, they used side scan sonar. They conducted grid searches on the seafloor. They crawled through thickets of mangrove and poisson trees. And they flew over the islands in small planes, and they used infrared photography. And with every new clue they found, it seemed like the mystery only got deeper. It was amazing. It's an amazing story, and Will Hilton has woven together the true story of the missing men, their final mission, the families that they left behind, and the real reason their disappearance remained shrouded in secrecy for so long. It was 60 years. So it's a wonderful book. It's a story of love. It's a story of loss, of course. It's a story of sacrifice and faith as well. Faith of the undying hope among the families of the missing. And I'm telling you, there was, I would call it, relentless determination on the part of some scientists, on the part of some explorers, on the part of some archaeologists, and some deep sea divers got involved as well. And they all worked to solve this mystery. And it is one of the really enduring mysteries of World War II. And it just amazes me that, you know, I'm thinking about this, the fact that here's this crew of 11 people that have been missing all these years, and you think, oh man, 11 people, how did that happen? And that's World War II. I'm telling you, there is a startling number of servicemen listed as missing in action from that war. There are 73,000 missing in action from World War II. That, to me, is an astounding figure. And Will Hilton has...
Hey, Judith.
Has brought us this story, and I think we're going to try and get him on by phone here now. Will, are you there?
I'm here.
I'm sorry we had so much trouble. We just lost him for a second. I'm sorry we had so much trouble. We'll have him now. We will have him on. We will have him on in just a matter of a minute. And we'll be able to talk with him about his book. I have to apologize for the delay today, but it's once in a while things don't work out exactly as we had planned. And here's a situation where things definitely did not work out the way they planned. But I'm really happy to have Will Hilton with us, and I think we got him on. Will, are you there? Let's see if we can get him on here. Will, are you there?
I'm here. Can you hear me okay?
Yes, I have to apologize. Thank you so much for taking time to be with us today.
Oh, no, thank you.
We have resolved our issues, and it's great to be able to talk with you on the phone about your book. And I have... while we were trying to resolve the issue, I kind of went through a pretty good description, I think, of what your book is about. You focus on, in a way, it's the issue of military servicemen missing in action. Is, you know, we've all heard about it, but to have so many, I mentioned that there isn't there something like 73,000 missing in action from World War II?
That's right. And of those 73,000, about 47,000 are missing in the Pacific Theater alone. So that makes up more than half of all MIAs for the last century of American history. Kind of a striking number. That number also happens to be almost exactly the same as the total number of combat casualties in Vietnam.
It's an absolutely amazing number. How did you happen to get so interested in it?
I sort of came in through a side door. I've worked for a long time as a journalist, and I was embedded with the military unit that's responsible for investigating sites where an MIA's remains are believed to be. And if they do turn out to be there, this same unit is responsible for doing the archaeological excavation to bring those remains home, and then doing the DNA testing that's necessary to verify and identify who they are. And then finally, those remains can be handed off to another part of the military apparatus to deliver to a family for a funeral, sometimes 70 or more years later. And so I went with this unit on what was intended to be a sort of a survey of their work sites, because they're constantly deploying all over the world, and they end up having to go to places that are sort of definitionally difficult to get to. You know, there might be a plane crash on top of a mountain or a shipwreck at the bottom of the ocean. And so they have to bring all sorts of specialized talents to bear on this work of getting to the site and then getting into the site and then trying to figure out what's there. And we got to the first of what were to be many places, and it was this barge out in the middle of the Pacific Ocean. And we were going to spend about a week there, and then we were going to go into the jungle of a nearby island. And then we were going to go to Southeast Asia and look at some work that was being done in Cambodia and Laos related to the Vietnam conflict. But as I got under this barge and I saw all these elite military members from all four of the different armed services sort of swarming around and doing some kind of massive project underwater, I realized that what I really wanted to know was what was down there and how did it get there and who was waiting for these answers that they were seeking, and what did all of this mean at this one place, so that it would become sort of an index or a proxy for the search writ large. And I decided to sort of burrow in, and you know, 5 years later, here I am still sort of invested in this particular site and this particular case.
Now, this is your book is just absolutely fascinating. I had a really hard time putting it down. You know, I think the interesting thing, and some people might not even consider this, but there seems to be a need and desire on the part of those families to know what happened to their loved ones. You know, even though it's 70 years ago, you talk about the concept, what is it, ambiguous loss?
Yeah. Isn't that striking to think about? You know, the people who do this recovery work, each one of them has to deal at some point with processing their own surprise and their own discovery of how fragile and raw these emotions can still be after so long. Because oftentimes when you're dealing with an MIA from World War II, the family member with whom you have contact is someone who didn't actually know the missing person, so has no sort of personal sense of who that family member was. It might be a son who didn't know his father. It might be a granddaughter, or it might even be a great niece or a great nephew. I've encountered people who are in their early 20s and are seeking out a great uncle that they never knew and who never played any part in their family story except by their absence. And it's that absence that's so palpable, that's so powerful, that it shapes people's family life growing up. Some of the investigators that I talk about in the book refer to these missing members as an empty seat at the dinner table year after year. And you hear stories from people who grew up where at every Thanksgiving dinner there would come a moment where grandma burst into tears because Uncle Joe had never come home. And so for these family members, the missing person, it's not so much about the history of the war or the history of that person per se, but about how the present family life is still affected by the loss. And the effort is not so much to recover the remains of that person as to recover the family they left behind from the abyss of the loss.
Will Hilton, our guest today, contributing writer at the New York Times Magazine and author of the book Vanished, The 60-Year Search for the Missing Men of World War II, a real page turn. I'm telling you, it's a wonderful book. I hope you'll have a chance to read it, and I hope you'll have a chance to ask him a question. You can join in, or maybe a story to share, at 1-800 642-1234. You can email us at talk@WPR.org. Or you can post on my Facebook page at The Larry Mehler Show. I'm Larry Mehler. Judith Sears Poisson, our producer on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Great to have you with us here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Larry Mehler here talking with Will Hilton, author of Vanished, The 60-Year Search for the Missing Men of World War II. You can join in with your own questions or comments at 1-800-642-1234. Go to my Facebook page. You can post there at The Larry Mehler Show. Chris in Adams County has been waiting a long time, so let's give him, Chris, a chance to join in.
You know what? The phone lines are breaking because even the cell phone lines are breaking because of the polar vortex. And we're going to just let Garrison Keillor play on this for the rest of his life if he has to, because it has been damn cold here. And so whatever else happens with regard to your situation is just justifiable. That's the first thing I have to say. Okay, my father
yes.
Flew, and I have to describe this plane to you because this is kind of an amazing, antiquated thing.
It was a bomber.
He flew spy missions into Nazi Germany from Dover, England, 24 inches over the English Channel. And he was the flight engineer on this plane, which means that there's a glass bubble on the bottom of this plane. And my father sat in that glass bubble, and he said, up, up, down, 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 up, 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 down, 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 for 24 inches over the landscape to escape the radar. He came back with really bad PTSD. But at some point, the pilot of this plane decided to rumble the plane over the English Channel because there's a great big hole in the middle of the plane, and they had to hand load the bombs in there in case they got artillery from down below or some kind of traffic from up above or whatever it was. And so the guys were standing around the bomb hole, and the pilot decided to rumble the plane, and they lost somebody over the English Channel. And that family is sitting out there not knowing what happened. And everybody shut up about it. The military shut up about it. Everybody shut up about it. And I'm living with the legacy of this in my life. And I'll get in touch with Mr. Hilton and tell him this story, because there are stories out there like this.
I thank you very much for calling, Chris. And Will, that's a terrible thing that happened to in that situation. And I expect you have heard those stories from others as well. It's typical or similar stories, let me say, from others.
I'm sorry to say that I have. It's just, it's an awful thing to try and comprehend what a family goes through when you have a loss like this that's compounded by the uncertainty. So, you know, we know that 416,000 men died in World War II, and any time that a family member dies, it's a unique tragedy. But there's a special character of grief that's associated with these MIA cases, some of which are not formally classified as MIA, but there are a whole series of acronyms that make up the missing as they're regarded by the military. And in a case like this, it would certainly qualify. And the reason is because the family can't say for sure that this man didn't survive somehow.
Yeah.
You can say with absolute certainty that it's unlikely. It's extremely unlikely. It's almost impossible. But that almost becomes an incredibly important pivot point for the family, who suddenly has the obligation to decide whether or not to hold on to hope. And so many times for these families, when you look at them from afar, you say to yourself, it doesn't make sense to be hopeful, or you shouldn't be hopeful, or you're torturing yourself. If he did survive, it would have been for a short while, or something like this. But when you're that family member, and you're the mom, or you're the husband or wife of a missing person, whether it's in war or not, what happens is you feel a responsibility to hold on to that hope, even if it's somewhat corrosive. One of the ways that I've tried to get my head around it is to imagine, if my little son were to disappear one day, what would I believe over time going forward? And the rational thing to believe would be that if he were alive, it's because something much worse than death is happening. And so you would think from the outside that that one would accept the death because it's preferable to the other alternative. But I know I wouldn't. I know in my heart that I would always hope to see him again someday and somehow make it right. And I think that's what these families have to deal with.
And there were, as you write, in your circumstance, or the circumstance you wrote about, I should say, there were rumors in some of the families that the men actually returned home in secret from this. Maybe you should go back and just kind of give us a little story, tell us the story of this bomber and how it vanished, and then let's talk about those rumors.
Sure. You know, one of the things that happened early on with this story for me as a storyteller was that I became aware of how much more there was to this case than anyone knew. There were so many unanswered questions, and at the time that I began reporting on this, there were still a few years left before most of the answers would come to the surface. So I was reporting into a story where 60-some years later, there still were a lot of things that didn't seem right about this missing bomber. The guys on the barge that I first witnessed were investigating the wreckage of what seemed to be a B-24 bomber, and they believed it was associated with a missing B-24 bomber that was shot down during a bombing mission over the Palau Islands on September 1st, 1944. But the problem was, during that shootdown, during that crash, witnesses in the air, in the bombing formation, saw parachutes pop off the plane before it went down. And so for all these decades later, it was unclear who exactly on the crew had popped off and survived the initial shooting and what had happened to them. And so family members for each of the 11 airmen who were on that plane, in each family, held on to some thread of hope that perhaps, you know, Jimmy or Johnny or Ted or any of the other airmen was one of the ones who survived. And perhaps he'd even made it out of the enemy territory somehow to safety, or was hiding in a cave, or had amnesia in the jungle, or any number of other possibilities. So all of these, I think of them as survival narratives that are sort of a feature of MIA families, were especially heightened in this case because it was clear that at least a couple of the guys, and nobody knew exactly how many, had survived at least for a little while. And it just lent credence and authority to the possibility that for each family that their guy was one of the ones still living. And then in a couple of the families, there were even more pronounced stories. And it wasn't clear to me at all when I started reporting on this how they were possible. For example, a guy named Tommy Doyle out in Snyder, Texas, had grown up hearing as a child whispering among his uncles and his other extended relatives that his daddy, Jimmy Doyle, had come back, had not only survived the initial crash, but had somehow made it home and then used the wreck and the MIA status as an opportunity to leave the family and to essentially abandon Tommy and his mom. And the story went that Tommy's uncles believed fully that he was alive in California with a new wife, two daughters, and occasionally called to check in, and that they had even been out there to find him, but he escaped just before they arrived at his apartment complex. He took off, and they were able to confirm, they said, with his landlord, that he had been living there. So this is what Tommy spent 60 years of his life wondering. Was it really possible that his dad had survived the crash and chosen to abandon him and his mom? And if so, why? Was there any reason that could make it okay?
It's just to have to live like that for all those years. It had to be just terrible. Well, you focus on several people who were involved in the search for the wreckage and the truth. And I really enjoyed how you go back and forth between the the events of the day as it was happening, and then back to the story of the search. And I think one person who especially seems an unlikely hero, but is really the linchpin of the whole present-day story, Pat Scannon, would you?
Yeah. Yeah, you know, Pat is an amazing guy. Here's a scientist out in California with no connection whatsoever to the Pacific Theater of World War II, no missing people from his family, no real consciousness of how the Pacific War was fought, or, you know, what the Palau Islands, what role they played in the campaign, had no connection to this plane whatsoever or the history surrounding it, and went to Palau with a couple of friends on a sort of a vacation to do some scuba diving, and happened upon a wing of a American bomber. He saw it at first from a distance, and he scrambled up to it, in laying in shallow water, and he described the sensation that he felt in that moment as a coldness that crept up from his toes to his scalp. And he knew in that moment that this wasn't just the wing of an American plane, but it was an American grave, and that the remains of some of the crew had to be still nearby. And he promised himself that he wouldn't stop until he had figured out what happened to those men and whether their families knew it. And to this day, Pat Scannon returns to Palau every year. And he's going back in about a month and a half to spend 6 weeks there searching for more of the missing aircraft, the American aircraft that went down in this bloody battle against Japan out in the middle of the Pacific Ocean. But the one plane that really captured his attention and that really took 10 years of his life out of this 20-year quest was this plane with Tommy Doyle's dad on it and 10 other men. And one of the reasons it captured his attention so fully is because the stories just didn't add up. Stories like Tommy's, and then the initial mission reports said that the plane had gone down in a very narrow, fairly shallow channel. But it had not. There was no evidence of the plane being there. And so as Scannon began the search, he thought it would be fairly quick to just scan that channel and find it. But he went back year after year, and he just simply couldn't. And he became increasingly skeptical about all the official stories and became determined to find out why the plane wasn't where it was supposed to be, where it really was, and what to make of all these stories from families like Tommy's about the survivors.
And there were, you know, there was some confusing or mysteries surrounding the crew. One is that there was a personnel change, and I don't know that that was ever really explained.
Yeah, that's right. You know, one of the things that happens when you're investigating a real-life mystery is that the peculiarities of human decision-making and the inadequacies of the historical record sometimes become insurmountable obstacles. And so there's this question about why the pilot of the plane that day, who had never flown with these 10 men before, suddenly was on the plane on its very last mission, and why the pilot, who always flew with that crew, had always flown on their missions and led their missions, was not. And I was able to find all of the surviving airmen who flew with these guys, and there's a very clear story that they tell about what explains the change. A lot of it was personality driven, and why. And how that was connected to the plane's fate. But there's no way to verify it in the historical record. These are stories that people tell 70 years later, and so you always have to try to weight that in the book to make sure that you leave room for those memories to be wrong.
We'll give our listeners a chance to join in. The number for you to call if you have an experience or comment, question, 1-800-642-1234. Let's turn to Barbara in Janesville. Barb, thank you for calling. Hi.
Hi. As I explained, I've got a little bit of a different twist on this. I have to explain, my father was a career military man. He fought in the Pacific Theater during World War II. And after the fighting, he obviously was still active military. And my mother's sister and I went over to the island of Guam to spend some time with him. And while we were there, my father was always very adamant that we not be out after dark. If we did go out after dark, we had to be with an escort. And as a child, the hut that we lived in, it was a Quonset hut. Across the road was a brick building that I presume was like a utility building for the island. And periodically in my child's mind, I would think I saw shadows over there, movement around that building. And I was only 4 years old at the time. So, you know, like I said, in my child's mind. Well, subsequently, these many years later, I read an article about a Japanese soldier who had been holed up on Guam and was somehow delivered from there in the 1970s. So he had stayed on the island for approximately 30 years. And so in the back of my mind, those shadows could have been those prisoners, and that's why, or refugees or whatever they're called, why my father was absolutely adamant that we not go out at night after dark.
Interesting. Will, a comment?
Yeah, you know, Barbara, that's an excellent point. I'm glad you brought it up. You know, when we talk about these survival narratives that haunted families, that's very closely tied to it. The Japanese soldiers especially continued to emerge on all different Pacific islands through the 1970s. In 1974, there was a Japanese backpacker, young guy, hiking through the Philippine jungle, and he came upon a Japanese soldier who still believed the war was going on, and who furthermore, even though the person who found him was Japanese, refused to believe otherwise, and instructed this young guy with the backpack that he was not going to leave his position until his superior officer relieved him of duty. And so, you know, sort of peculiar addendum to that story, the young Japanese guy actually did go back to Japan and return to the jungle with the superior officer who was still alive, fortunately, and the guy did relieve him of duty, and immediately the old soldier broke down in tears. And this was happening, you know, intermittently all through the 1950s, 60s, and into the mid-70s. And for these families who had someone, a U.S. soldier, go missing during the war, those stories of the Japanese soldiers emerging on whether it's Guam or the Philippines or Papua New Guinea, those stories formed a very central thread of their own narrative, in which it demonstrated that it was possible for someone to survive and to crawl into the jungle and to hold out, and it made it that much more difficult to imagine sort of giving up on those guys until there was an official explanation.
Yeah. Thank you again, Barbara, for calling. I appreciate your story so much. I know in the searching and in the discoveries that took place in Palau, the people of Palau, I think, were very important to solving this mystery. Maybe you could talk about their experience during and after the war.
Sure. It's a very powerful thing to travel to the Pacific Islands and get to know some of the islanders who were alive during the war period. Their memories almost uniformly are of a hostile imperial power in the form of the Japanese. And so whether it was an occupation like that of Palau that began decades earlier and became sort of tortured as the supply lines ran thin during the war and food ran scarce and the authoritarian regime became more strict, or in the case of other islands like that of Tarawa Atoll in the Kiribati Republic, where the Japanese showed up a couple days after Pearl Harbor and took over. In both those cases and in many of the other Pacific islands I visited, you find that the islanders were at the time and remain incredibly grateful to the American forces who came through and evicted their imperial overlords. That's not to say that they're still hostile towards the Japanese as a people. Nation to nation, in most of these cases, the relations have improved. But when they think back on these airmen and aviators, you know, and these sailors and these Marines who died on the beaches storming, you know, bloody Japanese garrisons trying to retake the islands, they feel an enormous and very personal sense of gratitude. And when someone shows up, whether it's from the military or an individual explorer like Pat Scannon, and says, hey, did you see a plane go down? Do you know where it was? Can you point me to it? The answer is almost always, yes, I can do it right now, and I'd be thrilled to do so.
Yeah, that's an amazing thing. And, I mean, they have been so helpful to us in finding those people. And it's such a... I couldn't help feeling. You have described very well in your book, I think, the kinds of the feelings of the family members and of the military people, the comrades, even though they were 70 years maybe apart, and the desire and urge to actually recover these bodies. Well, it wouldn't be bodies. You know, sometimes it's just bone fragments, isn't it?
Yeah, it really is. And, you know, when you hang out with these military archaeologists, many of whom are civilians working for the military, and in a lot of cases I've found they're not folks who would otherwise be affiliated with the military, but it's this specific mission that grabs them up. And they're very aware that what they're doing is the essential final step to a long piece of America's history. And, you know, in the case, for example, of Tommy Doyle, when I first came onto that barge in the Pacific, the people on the barge believed, the military service members believed that this was the plane that Tommy's dad had been on. But there was no way of knowing whether Tommy's dad went down with the plane, was one of the parachutists, and if he was one of the parachutists, whether any of Tommy's family stories were true. So Tommy didn't know what to make of the finding of parts of the plane, or whether to believe that that meant his dad was about to be found and that the stories told by his family were going to prove false and there would be this great relief, or whether his dad would not be found and the mystery would go on indefinitely until there was some kind of certainty. And so these military recovery teams who deploy to these far parts of the world, even after the plane has been found, perform this incredibly useful service by recovering fragment by fragment whatever remains and bringing it home to see if it can be confirmed by DNA as, you know, this gunner or that officer. And for the family members waiting like Tommy, there's just nothing more important in the world. The tears and the relief that you see on their faces when the answer finally comes are amazing.
Yeah. Carolyn in Arborvita, thanks for calling. Hi.
Hi. My story has to do with an uncle of mine. He flew on a B-24 Liberator over the hump. His base was in India. And on their way back, everybody had to bail out at night, Christmas Eve night. And he... waited till morning, and there's a Jap camp right below him, so he hustled off into the wilderness, met up with a group of Chinese guerrillas that were just out surviving, and they took him back to the, almost to the Burma Road, and the experiences he had were amazing, but what really shook him up, he said it was the worst part of the trip. The guerrillas took him to kind of a rough staging, and he found he was being auctioned off. There were Americans there with money and Japanese with money, and whoever paid the guerrillas the most got the airmen. And the Americans paid more, so Lee...
He got away.
Yeah, he went over the mountains on military vehicles. And I'm wondering about the setup there, because there must have been runners to announce, you know, that we're coming in with a prisoner.
With somebody, yeah. Wow, that's a story, isn't it, Will?
That's just, it's just so disheartening to think that a person's life can be reduced to an auction like that. You know, the whole story of the CBI theater, the Hump, China, Burma, India theater, is so little known to Americans. You know, this sort of the Pacific is already in the shadow of the European war, but then when you get onto mainland Asia and you look at the CBI or other parts of the conflict as it unfolded there, you know, there were just thousands and thousands and thousands of our guys who had to summon courage and make sacrifices and leave behind families with these kinds of questions in a place for which they got no recognition then or now, and about which most of us today are sort of blissfully unaware. We've managed to forget or expunge from our collective memory how brutal and awful it was for us to achieve what we enjoy today. So the people who haven't forgotten are the military and the searchers who are part of this unit that goes out and seeks them. They just got back, in fact, from a trip to the CBI on a truly extraordinary recovery operation they were attempting. So far, it's not complete, and they can't declare victory. But there was a plane that went down with one of their own teams aboard. So an earlier team had gone and found the remains of a bunch of American POWs who were executed by the Japanese and buried in a Japanese prison camp. And then after having recovered those remains, this military recovery team was bringing them home when their plane went down.
Yeah.
So now in the CBI theater, there's a plane that has the remains of World War II era POWs and the remains of the first recovery team that went to bring them home.
Oh.
And it's just one of these, you know, awful stories that comes out of these parts of the world where most of us have forgotten we ever had combat.
Well, Will, I want to thank you so much for taking time to be with us today. I will say that your story is just a real page-turner, and you are able to tie up the loose ends, which kept me reading right to the very last, at least as it related to this group of 11 men and their plane. And I want to thank you so much for writing the book and for taking the time to talk with us about it today. Appreciate it.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.
Yeah. Will Hilton is the author. I really hope you have a chance to take a look at it. The title of the book, Vanished, The 60-Year Search for the Missing Men of World War II. Fascinating story of solving a mystery halfway around the world, and that the people involved had to go deep under the waves of the ocean to solve it. I think that makes it even more intriguing. Coming up next, we're going to learn about what secrets underwater archaeologists can uncover right here in our own backyard. The Great Lakes have a wealth of history beneath the surface as well, and we'll learn about it next, right here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.